I'm Alex Shaw.
I'm Sharon Shaw.
And welcome to School of Movies. We've been the School of Movies for many years, and one of the things I have loved the most is being a teacher who learns as he goes. I adore being able to impart what I've studied up on, give you folks the best possible show on any given movie or any given everything else. But something occurred to me a while back when a rotten cold made me lose my voice. I've been listening to director's commentaries freed from their ancient DVDs and ever swiftly abandoned Blu-ray discs as we are all bodily propelled towards an all-streaming future where bonus features and extras are very rarely spotlit. Don't at me with, oh, they technically do have bonus features and extras on this thing. Just, they're not spotlit. The general public don't know about it. And commentaries just do not get listened to. They never much got listened to. I think the manufacturers of DVDs, the distributors, the people who loved film at the core of the construction of DVDs, hoped that the general public would get more involved. And they didn't, which would be why so many UK DVDs ended up with a lot less of that stuff. Also because each individual item had to be submitted to the BBFC for certification. But if there was demand for these things, there'd be supply. There's little demand. That doesn't make them not absolutely crucial if you love films. So this means that the period from the late 90s to, say, the late 2000s represents a window of the time a director or the crew or actors could sit down with a movie effectively by the side of the viewer and talk to them in an immediate sense about it. The slow erosion of these opportunities filled me with anxiety, and I started assembling an archive of commentaries in MP3 form, because even I, who loves these, I barely find the time in, what, the past 20 years to pull out the disc and watch a movie, even a favourite, with the director's commentary feature enabled. And there are a few scant websites which play host to these in MP3 form, sometimes abridged so they no longer match the time code of the films, but also make for better listening, because a lot of them can be quite dry and boring. They just kind of describe what's going on screen. That's a already showing you don't need to tell. And I thought about the commentaries of Guillermo del Toro that I already assembled and archived in their entirety a few years ago. Now, I've, in the past, heartily recommended that you folks listen to these commentaries over the years, but again, who has the time? Who has the discs? And who has the opportunity to do that? Especially as most of these commentaries are only on specific versions. For example, the earlier and later editions of Casino Royale 2006 on Blu-ray have a crew commentary, but only the deluxe one in the middle has Martin Campbell talking about his best film. Again, I only found this out a day ago when I realized I don't own that edition. And I was thinking, how can I give my voice a rest and still deliver to you folks a really fantastic show? The answer was simple on paper, though still requires an immense amount of diligent research, focus, and editing on my part. I just don't have to use my voice as much. Marrying up the rarity and intimacy of this dying form of artistic expression with the fact that we are literally a place of learning through audio broadcasting. So I would like you folks to all welcome to the stage our first guest lecturer, as it were, a man who has mentored me without knowing it for years. I have curated for you a presentation of his brain protein from various assembled commentaries, and there is plenty more just from this gentleman if you listeners like this format. So let me know on Twitter, Blue Sky, the Patreon, the Discord, via email, via carrier pigeon. Let me know whether you liked this and who else we might showcase on here as we delve deeper into the movies that we love and some movies we didn't know we needed to know so much about. Ladies, gentlemen, and everyone in between, kicking off with a lecture on Hellboy, would you please welcome the supernaturally talented and insightful Mr. Guillermo del Toro.
Hello, this is Guillermo del Toro, and you are watching the director's cut of Hellboy. Let me start by saying that, in my life, comic books have been a huge influence for me. I was a collector of comic books. Even before I learned to read, I was content and happy and seeing the images or looking at the cartoons. And as I learned to read, with both horror movie magazines and comic books. And along all my life, comics have remained as important an art form in my mind as film, theater, painting, anything. And the authors, if I had to single out the most important authors of comic books for me, they would be Will Eisner, Bernie Wrightson, Richard Corbin, and Mike Mignola. And Mike Mignola, in my later years, already as a young adult, fascinated me with his use of light and shadow, with his amazing bold line work, but also with the way he gave birth to my favorite superhero in my adult years, which is Hellboy. There was also a strange comic book in Mexico. There were several Mexican comic books that were a big influence in me. And, Fantomas was one, which was based on the serial character created in France. But also, there was a comic book called Duda in Mexico, which was in the late 60s, early 70s. It was sort of a Charles Forth, Eric von Daniken type of speculative science / occult fiction. This was my first exposure, this comic book, to one of the themes or the recurring themes in Mike Mignola's cosmology, which is the link between the Nazis and the occult. You know, this has been speculated by quite a bit in fiction and in film. The first and better known exponent of this is obviously the Indiana Jones movies, the Raiders of the Lost Ark and so forth. But, it has been speculated even before in Pulp Fiction and serials, and certainly in the Doug Savage, the Shadow, the Spider type of pulp novels, the Nazis and the occult walked hand in hand. And there is some fact to support these things. I mean, we based all the stuff that appears here trying to tie the cosmology of occult Nazi philosophies with Lovecraft and so forth, on things that had some base, at least some possible links. When I was writing the screenplay, I was investigating some of these. In the time when Hitler was growing up as a young man, Vienna was probably, one of the cities in Europe with the most activity around the spiritualism and the occult and so forth. Back then, also, many of the occultist works were trying to tie their theories with some form of pseudoscientific fact. And as a matter of fact, the Hitler joins, as expressed in the movie by Professor Broom, a society called the Thule Occult Society. Now, the Thule Society was founded on the legend that Ultima Thule, which was a legendary island in the ice-bound north and very much linked with Atlantis, was the center of civilization for the Aryan race. That all the secrets and the secret knowledge that the Aryan race was supposed to have from that lost civilization was guarded by highly intelligent extraterrestrial beings floating somewhere in outer space, and that could be contacted through magic, mystical rituals and incantations. So you can see that somewhat the Thule Society had a very Lovecraftian belief. In the movie, we use all this technology, like the bulbs and the gyroscope and the magnetic fields and electricity, which were extremely cutting edge back then, to sort of replicate the effect of the eclipse and the right hand of doom of Hellboy at the end. But all the scientific things that are there, some of which look very much like Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory equipment, are based into existing technology in the early 40s. Everything that makes Hellboy Hellboy is expressed in this sequence. His love for candy, him using his stone hand whenever he wants to get away with something, and the fact that the link between him and Broom is one of compassion and of love. You know, immediately Broom trusts him and takes care of him in this sequence. And from now on, the movie becomes the story of two fathers with a single son. He has one father in Broom and another father in Rasputin. It's a very graphic way of representing Hellboy's conflict. I think that this will also, you will find a little more fleshed out in this version than on the theatrical version, because we give a little more screen time to Hellboy and Broom, and we allow Broom to express more his concern for Hellboy and his well-being. This is a trait of Professor Broom that, to me, was quite lost before. Look at the birdie. Now we go into the title sequence, which I wanted to have be in the form of a labyrinth, because I felt that the labyrinth very well represented everything about the movie, about choices and taking different turns and choosing different destinies. You know, if a labyrinth, it is said, is not a place to be lost, but a place to find yourself. And that is one of the mystical principles of a labyrinth, or one of the ideas is that you can find your path in a labyrinth towards the right place to be, you know, and many labyrinths were created as mosaic work and a tile work in all the churches, Gothic churches. And walking the labyrinth while meditating and thinking or praying was a form of finding your own truth, your own self. And I thought the movie had enough images that were similar to labyrinths and bifurcating corridors and so forth. You have this labyrinth, you have the upcoming labyrinth in the ice cave here, you have the final labyrinth underneath the Moscow cemetery, and all these images, what they do is they basically represent the conflict that I think the movie has, which is Hellboy's conflict of choosing the right path. And the voiceover in the beginning and the end of the movie also says that a man is made a man by the choices he makes, not by where he's born or what the color of his skin is and so forth. Mignola, when we were first meeting in Portland, in Oregon, we went to a big bookstore, one of my favorite places in the world, called Powell's. And we wandered along the labyrinthian corridors of that bookstore, and we were getting books for each other to read. I was getting Piranesi books, and he was getting Doug Savage books. Turns out that most of the books we were trying to show each other, the other one had read. This is another scene that was restored in this cut and was not available before on the deleted scenes. And I think it's very important to see that not only Broom is being faced with the choice of dying peacefully in a hospital without pain, medicated, or arranging the future of his son. That is very important, but also the fact that he gets his final opinion from a diagnosis in a tarot card. He is dying, and he is going to die. But he chooses to go out into the world and start preparing everything for his son to be taken care of. And one of the first preparations he does is to choose his successor. Who is going to take care of Hellboy? Who is going to be the new ally, the new caretaker for Hellboy? And he chooses Agent Myers, which is played by Rupert Evans. And the reason why he chooses him is given later in a scene that I wrote after meeting with a lot of actors to play the part for Myers. When the screenplay had a few drafts, the actors kept asking me, what's what makes Myers unique? And I said, because he is a pure of heart. He is the young, fresh knight at the round table that will always have his heart in the right place and take the right decisions. He's the young knight that gets the chalice. You know, I think that Myers is characterized by Broom at one point as pure of heart. And that's the main thing in casting this part with Rupert. I was looking for the right actor, an actor that had innocence and purity about him, sort of a kid that the girls would be proud to bring to their mothers to meet, you know, and a kid that looked, ironically, incredibly clean, American, middle class, but was, in fact, British. And you know, we looked everywhere here in America, and most of the young actors looked really street savvy and had that sort of dark, edgy look that is very favored these days. And Rupert had this innocent quality about him. The statue in the background of Myers, which is an angel fighting a demon, this is a very characteristic statue found in many churches, especially in Mexico. This is a very popular statue representing good triumphing over evil. And when I was trying to give sense to the logo of the BPRD, because Mike never fully explains it, but it's a very combative logo of a hand holding a sword, and we started rooting it in Catholic mythology. And, you know, I felt the best way was to represent an archangel fighting a demon, as what Broom considers the BPRD's Arthurian, you know, Camelot-like function in the world. The dark needs the white to keep the balance. But what is great is that in the movie, they meet in the middle. You know, Hellboy is a monster that haunts monsters. Now, one thing that particularly infuriates me and is that this movie could have been made in 1998. By 1998, we had basically unchanged the screenplay of the movie, ready to come out. We would have come out way before X-Men, way before Matrix, way before Spider-Man. But back then, before all these movies were successful, the term comic book movie was almost an insult to studios. And we had a very tough time getting the movie set in a place that understood the premise, that understood that all these outlandish colors and all these outlandish things, demons being brought to Earth by mechanical Nazis and all these things, were in reality ways of speaking about simple human truths like freedom of choice, the purity of a love story between two beings that come from different backgrounds, and so on and so forth. And by the time the movie came out, some people were catching up the movie in 2004 and thinking it was an afterthought of, say, X-Men or Spider-Man or Matrix or this and that. But I was very happy to see people, for example, like Elvis Mitchell of the New York Times, absolutely nailing it. He, in his review of the movie, he said it's tough to bring a comic book character to life because the incestuous homage that comics paid to one another is so prevalent. Now, he gets it absolutely because comic books, much like pulps before them, I think that comics come from pulp novels, and they are closely related, and all of them are very incestuous. They use each other's mythology to create their characters and their tasks. But each superhero, if it's a good creation, manages to have something of his own or her own. You know, I think that Doc Savage, for example, which we were talking about before, existed only because The Shadow was a successful pulp. And The Shadow was so popular that they decided to create another hero. you know, everybody knows that Superman was first in comics, but, you know, Batman, for example, inherited the cape and the licorice suit, but also he inherited a lot of the traits of Dick Tracy, including a lot of gadgets and equipment with little signs pointing out the two-way wrist radio type of signs, and his bat belt and all the equipment he had was inherited from Dick Tracy. And everybody knows that X-Men and the Doom Patrol or Justice Society of America, Fantastic Four, the Champions, Seven Soldiers of Victory, these are all essentially the same group. Sometimes it's a wide-breadth group like Justice Society of America, which is all goody-goodies getting together to fight for against evil. And sometimes it has more of an edge. My favorite being actually Doom Patrol, which is also the one that influenced Mike Mignola the most in creating a BPRD. The BPRD existed in the comics as an organization already. I didn't, this was not my creation to create a group of misfits and freaks that get together to fight evil. This was in the comics by Mike Mignola, and he was influenced in turn by Doom Patrol, which was, I think, the better written of the comic book series, except for, you know, later X-Men incarnations in the 70s, which I love. But Hellboy was created as a movie, much like it was created as a comic book. Mike Mignola was trying to write the comic book he wanted to read as a kid. As he said, I just thought I'll put everything I like into the comic, and even if it lives only once, I'll be happy. I felt exactly the same way about the movie. And in making the movie, we were creating a movie that would be hopefully better loved by absolute geeks like us who love their comics and their movies and who have a wider reference list beyond Matrix and X-Men and the last 4 years of movies and the last 10 years of comics. And I think that you can trace some of those roots and have fun, both in the comic and in the movie. And, you know, I think that although I disagreed in the marketing of the movie with some of the X-Men elements used to market the movie, I must confess that I admire the marketing team for just tackling a movie and pitch it to an audience when, to me, it was a really hard movie to pitch. You know, the word hell alone in the movie created all sorts of funny or unfunny circumstances, starting with some theaters that would not carry the movie because of the hell in the title, to some theaters in the South that advertised the movie as Hello Boy because they were not happy with putting Hellboy next to The Passion at the time. Especially on Easter, some theaters mysteriously dropped the movie when it was still making money. And some toy chains refused to carry the toys because of the word hell in the boxes. We migrated studios for many years because most of the studios didn't like the title page, much less the screenplay. And there were other reasons, including the fact that both Mike and I, and Rick Baker and his team, we all felt that Hellboy was Ron Perlman. And the fact that for us, Ron Perlman has always been a star and was a star in this movie. And I want to talk about him for a little bit, for a touch. I met Ron 11 years ago when I was making Kronos, when I was preparing Kronos. And even back then, I was already in awe of the guy. I wrote him a letter asking him to be in my movie, a movie that had a very small budget for to pay an actor like him. I think we paid him about 5% of the budget to him. And it was a big effort to get him. And I wrote him a letter telling him that anyone that could do Quest for Fire and The Hunchback in Name of the Rose and then do Vincent in the TV series Beauty and the Beast was an actor with the range and the capacity for compassion in deformity and in weirdness that I wanted to work with him. And we met, and like all my great friendships, the friendship was sealed over food. I have gotten this fat because I have many friends and there have been many meals shared with them. And Ron and I went to an Indian restaurant, and I knew he was the actor to work for me because I said, "Do you mind if I start with dessert?" And he joined me into having two desserts before we ordered the meal. Now, also to his credit, he asked me some questions about the character in Kronos that were really intriguing and that I loved him thinking about. And they were not posturing questions. They were not questions trying to make him look intelligent. They were just were absolutely the smart thing to ask about the character. One of them was, he asked me if the character worked in that factory, if you saw Kronos. He said, "What do they make in that factory?" And I said to him, "It's been so long that no one remembers. The factory has been going for so many decades. They just make things, but no one remembers what they make." And he accepted such a surreal Mexican explanation, and a friendship was born. Also, Ron has something that most people don't value. To me, Ron Perlman is the Lon Chaney of the 21st century. He's an actor that not only knows how to wear makeup and how to make the makeup become alive, he is an actor that can be subtle in makeup. He can do nuance in makeup. Some great actors never get used to makeup. Some great actors are really good with it, Laurence Olivier being one, Peter Sellers being another one. But it is a gift. It's not something you train for. It's not something you can explain to somebody else as a performer. It's simply a gift, and Ron has that gift in spades. Also, he has one of the most beautiful voices, but he's capable of using it in a very colloquial way.
And this might be the ideal point for us to move to Kronos, Guillermo's first film from 1993, released in 2002 by Criterion, with this fantastic commentary.
This film was my first film, and when it was made, I was very nervous. It was one of the most high-budgeted movies in the history of Mexican cinema. It was, on the beginning, $1.5 million, which was gigantic for our film industry. It ended up costing $2 million. You know, all in all, it was an incredibly ambitious first movie, and incredibly ambitious for the genre in Mexico. The idea was to combine insect mythology, alchemy, and vampire mythology all into one. This branding iron mark on his hand, by the way, which you will see again when this character appears or reappears many years later, was supposed to signal his condition as a suspect to the Inquisition. The idea of combining Christian mythology or Catholic imagery and vampirism with insects and so forth comes from observation, just my sick mind, and the fact that I always thought that alchemy, Catholicism, and vampirism were somewhat linked. I think that there is a lot of vampiric elements to some rites in the Catholic Church, including, of course, drinking the blood of Christ and so forth. But there's also a very interesting alchemical link in the fact that both the Church, vampirism, and alchemy are ultimately about transforming matter into something more sublime or something eternal. The idea of these women wearing that jewelry and the fact that they had a living insect crawling around on their chests made a big impression on me. I've always been a fan of entomology. I've collected insects as a kid and observed them carefully, and was always in awe of how beautiful and how mechanical they look. And I was also a big fan of stories like The Golden Bug by Edgar Allan Poe, which had such a suggestive title, you know, such a beautiful title. And all these influences somehow gave me the idea of what if an insect existed in the real world that created a disease, a biologically correct disease that would create thirst for blood, longevity, lower metabolism, and ultimately an inexplicable change of skin, you know, and the renewal of cells and so forth. My second big love in life is sort of clockwork mechanisms and ancient machinery, and I hate digital technology. I use it, I love it as a user, but I just don't see the ingenuity in it. I think that the clockwork and automatons obsess me. I've always dreamt as a kid of owning and creating a life-size human automaton. You know, other kids were thinking about playing football or being astronauts, and I was just obsessed by gears and mechanics. So the movie combined all that, and I decided the only way to preserve this insect, this mythical insect, was to encase him in a mechanism that kept him alive. So the insect was vampirizing the victim, the mechanism was vampirizing the insect. In turn, the industrialists are vampirizing Mexico. And I just wanted to create sort of an ever-going chain of vampirism. You know, the most common knowledge of alchemy is that it transforms metals into gold. And yes, it does. And at some point of the process, you are meant to obtain or be able to transform vile matter into the most beautiful pure substance in the world, which back then gold was considered to be, you know, the ultimate expression of matter. You know, and the vilest of matters, the essential, original matter, was meant to be transformed into eternity. And the real quest of alchemy was the quest for the divine essence, you know, for the divine knowledge, and for the achievement of eternity. And the movie, as I said, shows you different characters struggling with time or eternity. The old man wants all of it, but he wants to use it locked up in his room, eating pills and not going out ever. And, you know, we show that at the end of the movie, you only achieve real freedom from time when you accept death, when you really embrace the fact that you are going to expire at some point. Your warranty is going to run out, and you're going to slowly unwind and stop. That's what makes the ticking so much fun. You know, I think that if we didn't have death ahead of us, it would be a very drab perspective. When alchemy is taken more seriously, and when you really start realizing that the quest is not so much for gold as it is for eternity and for living forever and achieving perfection, then, you know, I had to sort of not only color code the movie, but carefully take the character through all the process. You see the character going through water, fire, earth, air, and so forth. He is burnt, quote unquote, which is one of the processes of alchemy. He is reborn, and he has to peel off his skin and start revealing new layers and so forth. And at the same time, I wanted him to go through sort of a passion, because he is an imperfect Jesus. He is a great Jesus, and he is ultimately going to be born and resurrected, and he's going to give life, give his own life to save the life and redeem those that he loves. So I wanted him to, if you notice in the movie, he dies and resurrects on the third day. When he raises from the dead, he has stigmata, both from the device on his hand and his chest, and on his feet from a piece of glass. We will see that in a few minutes. But he goes through that, and then he wears a red velvet cape over his shoulders, a red, sort of raggedy red cape around his shoulders, like Christ had during his passion. And he bleeds, and he, you know, the way he ultimately behaves is like a savior. He's a messiah for the girl and for his own life and for his own mortality. So these things are coded in the movie here and there with the little different elements. And I think that there is some very heavy Catholic feel of redemption through pain throughout the movie and throughout, frankly, most of the things I do. I think I'm not into masochism, but I really think that we spend too much time avoiding the ugly and avoiding pain. And I think that's the value of the horror genre, that it puts us back in touch with pain and puts us back in touch with the nasty side of life, you know, the dark side of life. Most people spend their lives after 30 trying to look younger, trying to achieve, you know, perpetual teenage years. But I frankly, I'm thankful for aging. And I'm thankful for pain. I have learned much more from pain than I have ever learned from success or, you know, just a good pat in the back. You know, this movie was such a nightmare to make from an economical standpoint and from a personal standpoint because, you know, when you're producing officially or unofficially one of your own movies is very difficult to deal with the day-to-day problems. But those problems taught me more than awards or, you know, good reviews and so forth. This is the first time that I used in a movie a thing that I now use in every movie and I love, which is to sort of juxtapose a very cold light and a very warm light source. You know, I use it on Mimic. You can see the chemical flares again on Mimic and again on Hellboy. I love those chemical flares. But through the years, I have become very fond of juxtaposing very cold light and a very golden source. And this coming up with Jesus reading the diary was the first time we did it. The collaboration with Guillermo Navarro is one of the closest I have professionally with anyone. I haven't done movies without him. I have done Mimic and Blade 2 without him and a few TV episodes without him. But most of my life I have worked with Guillermo. Here's that scene, you know, here's that shot. And we have come to, you know, love and respect each other profoundly. We are compadres. I am the godfather of his son. And we live about 5 minutes away from each other. We go to the gym every day together. We have a cup of coffee every day and chat about our lives. And he knows what makes me tick. He would never suggest or try anything that he knows I don't like. And I have actually had only one time in our life we had a discussion. It was very brief, and it was the first day we met. I was a storyboard artist in a movie called To Die, Death in the Gulf, Muerte en el Golfo, Alejandro Pelayo's film. And I was trying to approach Guillermo to shoot Cronos already. And he was famous for being a very short-tempered DP. And everybody was afraid of Navarro. You know, everybody in Mexico said, well, he's the best, but he's also very short-tempered, you know. And I must say, I met him, and I was very quiet. And I was doing the storyboard for the action sequence, and I saw him put a 50-millimeter lens. And I said to him, that's the wrong lens. You know, I drew a longer lens on the storyboard, and he was looking through the eyepiece of the camera, and it was a low shot. So I was up, and he was down looking, and he looked up with absolute hatred, and he told me, look, you brat, show me that you know what the lens does, and then we'll talk. And I really got very angry, and I walked in front of the camera at the right distance, and I said, the close-up will start here and end here on the 50, and what I want is... And I use my hands to show the scope of the shot. And I said, and with a longer lens, you'll get this and this. And he smiled from the camera and laughed. And from that day on, we have liked each other and we have never, ever argued. In Kronos, there's a shot on a scene that was removed where I said to him, shouldn't we make the shadows deeper and maybe remove some of the light? And he said, look, I'll do it this once to show you how, what it looks like. And then, you know, just tell me what you want, draw me a picture, show me what you want, and, you know, let me do my work. And, you know, he did that one take that way, and it came out and it was ugly. And when he showed me what he had done with the light, it was beautiful. And I like the way he uses cross-lining and little highlights, and I have never questioned it. And that was the one and only time I asked the question, you know. By the same token, every single camera position or every move or how the camera starts and where it ends, I have always decided, and he has never questioned. You know, he never has said to me, that's impossible, let's not do it. You know, I always tell him, I want this size of lens or the camera to go from here to there and to start here and there. And, you know, even in a movie like this, he never questions it and just does it. This operation, this camera operation that he does in this little scene where he gets stabbed, is all handheld. And it just so happens that I think Guillermo Navarro is one of the best operators I have ever met. Now, the thing with Ron Perlman that struck me the most is the balance of his humor and his... you know, he's a very comical actor that very seldom gets to play those over-the-top funny characters. But when he does, he loves it. And I, we used to say, you're not only a ham, you're a ham full of mustard. And I really think that every time we did something like this that was so broad and so over-the-top, we enjoyed each other. And we have been doing ungainly over-the-top stuff ever since. But when we met at a restaurant in Beverly Hills. And I was very nervous because Ron was the first international actor that I admired, that I met. And, you know, we had a very, very nice dinner. We actually started with dessert. We had two desserts and then went into the main course secretly. The reason this happened is because I had no money, and I was supposedly the one inviting, the one buying the dinner. And I wanted dessert very bad, and I didn't know if I could afford dessert at the end of that dinner. So I started with it and ate very little afterwards, frankly. And, you know, Ron will tell you an anecdote, I'm sure, if you ever meet him, where, you know, in this movie, there would be takes where I would say, first take, print, check the gate, which means it's the final take. And Ron would say, can I have one more? And I would say, no, it's perfect, my friend. You don't need another one. Oh, yes, I do. I love this crane, and I love the... I mean, we did really good for what we had, lighting night for night in such huge spaces with no money. I think Guillermo Navarro really did fantastic for the budget we had. But at any rate, Ron would insist on having another take, and then I would have to pull him aside, and I would say, we have no more film. I can't afford another take. So there's a lot of in the movie that is a first take here and there, you know. And I think you know, it's part of shooting on such a shoestring budget.
Which now brings us back to Hellboy.
And you know, I wrote every piece of dialogue for Hellboy thinking of Ron. I knew his strengths, I knew what he was good at, one of those things being a very dry, extremely dry, almost sandpaper dry humor. And I gave him a lot of that type of humor and sort of one-liners that came out of the situation. Not one-liners that were cute or would be hip. I don't think the movie is hip in that sense. It's almost anti-hip. He doesn't say, I'll be back, or things that are just theater the theater fills with roar and laughter. It's just, he just seems to be a dry commentator of the situation. In other words, he has an ordinary point of view about extraordinary circumstances and missions that he does. You know, he has, like all of us, he has that desire to do the most work with the less effort. He has that underachiever quality that makes him adorable to me. Now, another influence that Mike Mignola has that I think is important to talk about is that of Jack Kirby. You know, for those that are familiar with Jack Kirby and his comics, he was an artist and a writer. He's less known as a writer than an artist, but of extraordinary stature. He created hundreds of superheroes and characters that are now icons in comic books. You know, he created X-Men, Fantastic Four, Hulk, Captain America, Sergeant Fury, Silver Surfer, Captain Victory, the New Gods, Mighty Thor.
The Eternals!
I mean, most of the pantheon in the Marvel Comics library was created by Jack Kirby, or allegedly co-created with Stan Lee. And his imagination had sort of a hard-boiled, tough guy edge, and at the same time, a fancy, absolutely incredible power to dream worlds and universes and mythologies. You know, rivals Lovecraft or Lord Dunsany or Jules Verne or Edgar Rice Burroughs, any of these writers. I genuinely think that Jack Kirby is as important a cultural influence as any of the more recognized pulp writers or people like Burroughs or in fantasy. I think Kirby was very neglected in later years, and finally, I think he's achieving some of the notoriety and the fame that he deserves. He started way in the beginning as an in-betweener artist for animation at the Max Fleischer Studios, and I think that gave all of his drawings this very fluid, vital sense. You know. Oh, by the way, the guy playing the driver is one of my best friends in life, Santiago Segura, who is the greatest comic actor in Spain. And here we see him at his thinnest. Anyway, talking about Kirby, his figures all have that motion, the sense of motion that comes from him working in animation. And, you know, right now, that school of drawing that Kirby created, where the characters were very kinetic and incredibly powerful, is now totally absorbed in the post-McFarlane, post-Jim Lee era of comics. But most fans don't remember or don't care to remember that the guy that invented it all was Kirby. Mignola shares with him not only this fascination with movement, but a movement that is executed by figures, by characters that look straight out of a Russian realism painting. Both Kirby's and Mignola's superheroes have this larger-than-life, almost totemic size. You know, when a hero like Captain America or Commandy or Demon is jumping in the page and reaching forward, is like a more than human representation of human power. And the same is true for Mignola, especially in the case of Hellboy. A lot of the other stuff that Mike has done can be traced to influences like Alex Toth in The Inking or this and that, but his motion on Hellboy, his sense of action, is totally Jack Kirby. And we tried very hard in the movie to capture this Kirby-esque action sense. Here is another extension in the movie where I give Liz a chance to reply to Meyer's proposal. I loved this little exchange, And I introduced a motif that was created for the movie, which was Liz using those rubber bands to keep her character at bay and not exploding. This is something I learned actually when I was working as a voluntary in an insane asylum in my hometown in Guadalajara. It was a long story, but I picked up a guy that had an accident in the street, and turns out he was mentally deficient. And I took him to the hospital, and they sent him to a mental asylum. And when I went to visit the poor man to see how he was the next day, he had escaped. And I went to the director of the asylum and said, why is it so easy for patients to escape? And she said, well, we are short of hand. If you care that much, why don't you join the staff? And I proceeded to join the staff. This mental institution was strategically placed behind a 19th century cemetery and next door to the morgue. So during the period I was in that institution, which was a brief few weeks, I was exposed to some of the most beautiful funereal monuments, where I used to have my lunch and write a little, and a cemetery called Belen, and a cemetery I visited many years after that, and at the same time exposed to the most horrible things on my way to my car in the parking lot through the morgue. But one of the things that I picked up during that stay is that they gave some of the patients, since they couldn't give them the exact assistance they needed, they gave them little tricks to keep themselves at bay. And one of them was that to use the rubber bands to help themselves, remind themselves that they were about to lose their temper. Now, another influence in the movie that it will become apparent in a few seconds will be the influence of Ray Harryhausen. Mike and I started talking about Hellboy as a Ray Harryhausen movie because if one is to believe that in the horror genre there is a subgenre that is called the monster movie, and in which in that movie the sole purpose of the movie is to showcase the monsters as much as possible in absolute a contrarian impulse to the well-known law that is not seen is more scary. Monster movies are supposed to be fun, and no monster movie was more fun than a movie with animation by Ray Harryhausen. Harryhausen had such a strong personality that his movies are known as movies created by him, even although he didn't write or direct the movie. I mean, he came up with the ideas, but didn't personally wrote the screenplay. And these movies influenced Mignola and I, and we wanted the battles of the monsters to be very Harryhausen-esque and Jack Kirby-esque. And we went for that type of dynamics. Some of the battles happen in full frame, like the battle of Hellboy versus the Seven Samuels in the cave at the end. That is totally the way a Harryhausen fight would have been staged, with very little camera movement or no camera movement, and in a wide shot. I met Harryhausen, along with Mike Mignola, a couple of years before doing the movie. And we actually propositioned to Harryhausen that he would come in and teach the animators a little bit of what made his technique so unique. And he didn't want to do it. He felt that movies nowadays were very violent and so forth, and he declined. But I had the chance to see him afterwards a couple of times, including having the privilege of having dinner at his house in London and becoming acquainted with one of the most fascinating substances in mankind's history, which is clotted cream. I devoured a large portion of clotted cream at Harryhausen's house, saw his models, and in talking to him, I heard a couple of things that helped me plan things on Hellboy. He said he had been influenced very much in his set design and in his conception of monster layers by Gustave Doré, and that he loved the classic sense of proportion that Doré had in designing monsters. And we kept that in mind very much through the process of designing the sets for Hellboy and the creatures. Obviously, some are more outlandish than Doré would have imagined. There were not many tentacles in his engravings. But also, he, Harryhausen, enunciated a beautiful thing. He said, most people animate monsters acting like monsters, being mean and destructive and this and that. He said, monsters should be thought of as animals. For example, Samuel was very much based on the movements of gorillas and dogs, to the point where in a few seconds you will see him do what I call a Scooby-Doo skid, when he, like a dog running on tile, kind of skips in chasing the agent right here. That's a Scooby-Doo skip, you know, in a sort of gorilla body. And Harryhausen said something that the best animators like Phil Tippett do. He said, you should always imagine the monster in repose. He said, don't imagine the monster doing the bad things. Imagine the monster as you would see a lion if you wandered into their patch of the land in Africa. And we put this to good use later on in the movie when they wander into the egg chamber underneath the Moscow catacombs. If you watch carefully, there's a Samuel actually just peacefully gnawing on a bone, a femur, just like a lion, you know, eating his last shred of meat when it raises its head and discovers the hunters that he's about to devour. And this little moment, which is extremely Mignola-esque, extremely Jack Kirby type of action, with the superhero and the villain tangled in a battle spiraling down. You know, this is extremely comic book, Jack Kirby, Mike Mignola-esque type of action. As is the rest of this fight. I wanted very much to make the fights sort of two-fisted fights, not acrobatic, not martial arty, because we had done already Blade, and I felt this had to have the sense of a brawl between two creatures. Now, Hellboy is a very dear movie to me, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because before it, by accident, if not by design, the movies I did fell neatly into two categories. You know, you had things like Chronos or Devil's Backbone, and that were like very personal, small, sort of art house horror movies and so forth. And things like Mimic, Blade, being the big spectacle Hollywood genre action movie and so forth. And to me, Hellboy is both. Hellboy is not only a movie that contains very personal moments for me. I see it as a close reflection of the way I see life and love and a sense of choice one has when just going through life. But also, it's a big fun romp with big fights and big action and so forth. And I think that it's a combination of those two. And to me, Hellboy was almost the beginning of a new life or a new chapter in my life where I could hopefully do big movies that were at the same time very quirky and very personal. And I think that I was blessed by having Mike Mignola entrust me with his character to make this movie that way. Because it is as much a Mike Mignola creation as it is a Guillermo del Toro movie done with the care and the love that the small movies had and the spectacle and hopefully the scope of the other big movies. Hellboy is or was a movie that was hard to get off the ground precisely because we wanted to keep all the quirkiness it had. Just the very fact that the guy was red and that the red guy got the girl at the end, that was very freaky for most of the Hollywood studios where they kept asking, is he going to be really red? He's not going to have a tail, is he? I mean, a few days ago, Matthew Robbins and I were writing a story for the Hellboy anthology, Other Jobs, and Matthew came up with a beautiful paragraph in which two kids are being rescued by Hellboy. And as they are being rescued, they start screaming because they catch a glimpse of his tail. And I think the tail freaked out a lot of people for some reason. I myself don't understand it. I think it's a very beautiful compositional element in Hellboy. And it's sort of a mood teller. It tells if Hellboy is happy, if he's relaxed. If he's relaxed, he's waving his tail. I like that very much. And I even give it a close-up in a scene coming up when he's writing to Liz. I give it a very peaceful close-up, like you would to a cat's tail. But for some reason, these little elements freak out people. There is a country that bought the movie for international release that had a most extreme reaction to the red guy getting the girl. And I found that really funny. It's sort of a surreal racism. But, you know, I think that that's the beauty of movies like this, or genre movies, that they can talk about things larger than just monsters with metaphors. And I think that those reactions are not unlike another Hollywood project in which I pitched to the studio that the hero of the movie should be an African-American and have a wife that was white. And their reaction could have made proud a sheriff in a small town in the 1950s. You know, it's ultimately the monster to me is the last ultimate minority. You know, people's reaction towards monsters are perfect reflections or of other little hangs that people have, be it racial or social or sexual. And that's the power of horror movies in reality. The key emotionally to the movie was to have the father and son story and the man and woman love story. The easy version of this tale is that of Beauty and the Beast. You know, Beauty and the Beast, that even in the best, most beautiful retellings, demands that the beast gets turned back into a prince in order for the love story to work. And I wanted very much not to do that. I wanted the beauty to turn into a beast at the end, to fully assume her mortal gifts, her deadly gifts of fire. And when she accepts herself for what she is, a monster, then she can love the monster. And I found that to be a very liberating premise, and one that has quite frankly worked very well in my personal life. Cronin became much more of a fetishistic, attractive sort of a killing machine in the movie. Broom, for example, in the comic, dies extremely fast. He dies in the first 10 pages, I think, of the first series called Seed of Destruction. But in subsequent novels and short stories, graphic novels and short stories, Mike Mignola has expanded upon the role that Broom had as a father with Hellboy. So I felt that we needed to extend his function and delay his death up until this moment to make it really painful to lose him. It's terrible to kill a character in the first 5-10 minutes because you don't have yet any attachment to him. But to kill Broom here and to kill him while Hellboy is out is such a guilt trip. It's such a terrible thing to have Hellboy go through that I wanted to do it in the movie. I wanted Hellboy to change from now on. From this moment on, Hellboy becomes more of a man. His decisions, the way he approaches every conflict is less childish, hopefully still very charming, but this is the pivotal point of Hellboy's change. By being out in what amounts to a silly jealousy thing while his father was being killed, I felt that Hellboy would gain enough of an emotional motor to change. And I think that I didn't want to have the character articulated. You know, some people when writing screenplays are very tempted to have the characters articulate what happens, much to the dismay of people that like that type of screenplay. I don't do it like that. So some people have to live with the fact that I think characters are defined by what they do and how they interact with each other, not by monologues in a coffee shop where they confess to each other what their life is. And I think Hellboy, to me, is defined as a changed, lonely man in an image of him watching the funeral from afar in the rain and not being able to participate because he's a monster. And from that moment on, there's a nuance changing on a Hellboy. He's more efficient. No one, from now on, no one will just hear him be glib or joke. He has a different gravity from now on. Some of the edits from this point on in the movie were done with that in mind. But he doesn't tell Liz, as I said, he doesn't tell Liz, I was not here when he died. And I will never, ever fail anyone else again, blah, blah, blah. He just is very changed. Another character that was extremely different by extension than in the comics is Liz. Liz in the comics is older. She's much savvier and skeptical. And she is sort of a post-gothic, really smart, snappy chick, you know, is like very self-sufficient. And I wanted Liz to be so full of self-doubt in the movie that she's not capable of controlling her powers. And I was hoping that through this line of exploration, you could get Liz to come to the point where she says, hit me. I want you to hit me. I want to lose control. Because, once again, if the love story talks about what I think love is, and not at the risk of sounding like a newspaper comic book strip from the 70s, I think loss of control is hand-in-hand, goes hand-in-hand with true love. You have to relinquish control. And the battle between Hellboy and the creature is patterned or trying to achieve a little bit of the fluidity that I admire in animation. On Blade 2, I was basing a lot of the violence and the action of Blade 2 on anime, Japanese anime. In a post-Matrix world, most people see that type of action as Matrix action, completely negating the fact that that type of action was first existent on anime. And I think anime, Japanese anime, is one of the biggest influences in the 21st century culture ever. And it's going to permeate the next decade or two decades of pop culture. And the first movie to embrace anime was Matrix, without a doubt, using the same type of techniques. And in Blade 2, we tried to do just that with more extreme graphic, gory elements, taking their cue from anime. But this, I wanted to have an almost Walt Disney type of feel. And the thing that I was quoting to the animators was Prince Philip fighting the thorns at the end of Sleeping Beauty, or, you know, Hercules battling the many-headed Hydra. And just to have that fairy tale moment that also Mignola uses a lot, where Hellboy grabs a giant broken sword and goes at it against the monsters. Now, this final scene, I think, is one of my favorites. I have done only 5 movies, and I love the most Devil's Backbone and Hellboy. And this final image of them kissing in the fire is one of my favorites. And this set, and the way Guillermo Navarro, the DP, who's a great friend and a great collaborator, he dealt with this in such a great way. We needed some backlight to silhouette the characters a little bit, but we needed enough of darkness to feel the effect of the fire kiss. And we were at the same time in a very constrained space. And, you know, all this dry, technical impositions that you go through when shooting a movie. And I must point out this moment as one of my favorite things he has done. And I wanted very much to have Selma look as pale and as beautiful as a fairy tale heroine, very much Snow White against the Red Hero. And Navarro helped me a lot by using a very cool light. We were using a very cool gel-colored filter to illuminate this corridor. It's not the same type of blue that we were using in all the nights or the other interiors. This was a special type of blue that we selected because it would help not to obliterate the red, which can be very, very conflicting with blue gels, and at the same time make her skin, which you'll see right now in her close-up, absolutely fairy tale white. You know, she looks like an Arthur Rackham illustration of Snow White. You know, and I that's what I hoped the movie could achieve at the end. A fairy tale, a fable told to myself when I was 11 or 12 years old. I would have loved to see this movie at that age, and I would have loved to meet Hellboy at that age. I still felt that same pang when I started reading Hellboy at the ripe age of 30 or so. But I envy and I hope that some kids out there had this experience with this movie, and I hope they will treasure it as they grow up. And with that, I say goodbye.
Massive gratitude to Guillermo for being the first guest lecturer at the School of Movies. We are a publicly funded institution. We do not do advertising. You can support us on Patreon, get access to even more goodies every week, and we'd like to thank our top-tier sponsors, Aaron Burns, Aaron Lecluse, Abel Savard, Alejandro Vargas, Alex Brewington, Angus Lee, Benjamin Hoffer, Brian Novak, Cassandra Newman, Chris Finnick, Christopher Wolf, Kieran Dashler, Connor Kennedy, Dan Mayer, Daniel Salgueiro, Dan Hettner, Dave Hickman, David Sheely, Finbar Nicole, Frankie Punzi, Greg Downing, Jameis Enright, Jesse Ferguson, Joe Crow, Joel Robinson, Jorn Clausen, Joe Gluck, Josh Powelsland, Kevin Vahey, Lorraine Chisholm, Marty Pollmeyer, Matthew A. Siebert, Michael Hasko, Sean Doran, Toby Skilzungius, Tim Rosensky, Timothy Green, Tom Painter, Timu Helishayo, Tyler Long, Sarah Montgomery, and Kat Esmond.